Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman from Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. This is the show where we try to take topics with speakers who typically might be at national conferences and bring them to anyone that's interested at a price they can afford, which is free, and bring it to you at the time when maybe the issue's in front of you. Today we have, a really neat show. I haven't really seen a show like this before at other conferences. We're talking about what happens when a judge lets you down, although I think it's a topic lots of lawyers think about, and this is particular to electronic discovery when they let you down in that regard. The panel today is a really excellent panel. First of all, when you think about judicial education, anyone that knows the area thinks of Ken Withers, who's the Director of Judicial Education and Content for the Sedona Conference, which, as people listen to the show know, is an Arizona-based nonprofit law and policy think tank, which is on the forefront of issues involving technology, civil justice, intellectual property, and antitrust law. Ken is widely published. He's published several papers on electronic discovery, including computer-based discovery and federal civil litigation, the observations on the Sedona principles, two tiers in a safe harbor, federal rulemakers grapple with electronic discovery, did a 90-minute instructional DVD with one of my favorite judges in the field, Judge Shira Shindlin, on electronic discovery, and on and on. Lots of activity in this area. Ken, I'm glad you're on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And we also, I just saw Cecil Lynn just popped onto the show, so right on time. And Cecil is a recognized thought leader in the area of electronic discovery. He speaks and publishes on a wide variety of e-discovery topics, including document review. And he speaks in document retention, data accessibility, and international e-discovery. He's an active member also of the Sedona Conference, serves as an instructor for the National Institute of Trial Advocacy, where he teaches courses in electronic discovery, deposition skills, and trial advocacy. He's of counsel at Riley, Carlick, and Applewhite. And Cecil, glad to have you on the program as well.
Well, thank you. It's glad to be here.
Along with Ken, both from Phoenix, Arizona, or in that area. I'm going to make a reference to Phoenix in a second. But Steve Badger, the third panelist, is a member of a law firm in Indianapolis, Bowes, McKinney, and Evans, in the litigation group. He represents clients in commercial and complex business litigation matters and appeals. His litigation experience is in First Amendment, media law, cases, defamation, and class action defense. He also lectures to attorneys on electronic discovery. And glad to have you all on the show.
Thanks, Carl.
Before we get into sort of the meat of the issue of what happens when judges let you wrong in e-discovery, which I sort of wanted to throw out a reference to, you know, this is sort of the griping that sometimes you hear from anyone that loses. What happens when the person in charge of overseeing the, you know, I mean, my best example is what happened in the Super Bowl when the Pittsburgh Steelers, I'm in Pittsburgh, won the Super Bowl. You might say the refs might have let you down. I don't know if you're in Arizona. But anyway, you know, it is something that sometimes people have concerns about. But before we get into that area, how did each of you get into electronic discovery? Why don't we start with you, Ken?
I started in on electronic discovery back in the mid-1980s when I was in private practice, mainly doing corporate defense work, but my particular specialty was of course, discovery and document review and complex litigation. And one thing that I began noticing back in 1985, 86, 87 was that most of the documents that I was getting from my clients or from the opposing side were documents that had been generated through some kind of word processing. Of course, in those days, we were getting everything in paper form, but we could see that there were these little alphanumeric slugs at the bottom of most of the pages. We quickly were able to figure out that those were the tracking numbers for the electronic files in those giant Wang word processing systems that some of you of a particular age may remember. And so I began in discovery asking for drafts or versions of documents related to the word processing slugs. First from my clients to be able to make sure that I got everything, and then also from the opposing side. So that was a form of primitive electronic discovery. Although the form of production was still in paper, we were acknowledging early on that the real documents were in electronic form. And then in the early 1990s, I began to see a lot of email messages in the paper discovery. I remember once I had some litigation against the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and I went back to the young Commonwealth attorney who was signed to that case, and I asked her if I could please have all of the relevant email in this case, and she looked at me quizzically and didn't know what email was. So I had to show her the paper versions that she had already produced from her own clients' files and say, this is what we call email, and it's a form of communication that your clients are using all the time. Are you familiar with it? And she was not. So that goes back to the ancient history of electronic discovery. I retired from the practice of law in the mid-1990s and decided to go back to school and get my degree as a law librarian. But what I discovered then was that more people were interested in law and technology than in 18th century British contract litigation, which was my specialty. So I began doing more and more lectures and judicial education, in particular about law and technology issues, and particularly electronic discovery. And that brings us up to today.
Okay. Cecil, how did you get into electronic discovery?
Well, much kind of in the same way that Ken did. I mean, it started out with complex litigation and primarily document reviews, and this would have been in the late 90s time frame when I thought it was really interesting that many of the documents that came our way for review had been taken from an electronic system, printed out, and then scanned back into the system, sometimes with OCR, sometimes without. And the OCR fields that had been generated oftentimes were rudimentary at best, to, from, redate. But that most of the work that we did was just the general review of these documents. There wasn't really much searching that went on because a lot of times, for instance, in the asbestos cases, the words that you were looking for, you know, did not appear in the title or the subject of a particular memorandum. And then I got involved in a case where, and it was actually an interesting issue. We had representing the defendant and the plaintiff, which was the former employer of my client, had hired a forensic specialist to pull data from a print spooler. And the data that they pulled from the print spooler was actually a memorandum from my client to counsel, basically executing his exodus from the company. When they pulled that document from the print spooler, they immediately sent it to a national news publication that published the document in its entirety. So we went to the judge trying to get the document, I guess clawed back, if you will, as an inadvertent communication. And the judge, while sympathetic, said, look, the document's out there. It's in this national publication. There's not much that I can do. That document then became the springboard and set the tone for the trial that was not great for us, but it really did pique my interest in electronic discovery as it related purely to getting electronic information from electronic systems and using that information, whether it be affirmatively or defensively, as opposed to relying on scanned documents or OCR documents, and have been kind of in the forefront of assisting my clients in managing their electronic information, and also writing on the subject to try to kind of help advance the ball in the area.
And how about yourself, Steve?
Well, I started litigating the business cases in the early 1990s, just about the time when e-discovery was really becoming part of the normal process, the kinds of things that you see generally in those types of cases, and almost a routine part of that sort of practice. I've had my deepest and earliest exposure to the issues in a case where it was a class action case representing a large financial company, and the plaintiffs were very aggressive about requesting information about some proprietary software and a database that our client had maintained, and it was an instance of where limitations on discovery were not really put into effect by the state court trial judge, was not keeping a lid on it. So that was a very illuminating experience in terms of getting heavily involved in these sorts of issues. But I've been on both sides of them, unfortunately, on questions of spoliation too, and a couple of cases where electronic discovery was litigated very aggressively, and I've been on both sides of the issue.
Okay, and that sets the issue up pretty well there. Ken, let's start out first by talking about some of the differences between judges. You know, the differences between state and federal judges, education, resources. There were a number of issues that you wanted to sort of lay out sort of as a framework on differences between judges.
Well, there, of course, a lot of the differences between judges have to do with differences between jurisdictions, between forums, whether you're in federal or state court. Our federal courts are known for more hands-on case management, an active case management philosophy, particularly our magistrate judicial corps. Maybe not so much the district court judges, but depending on the district you're in, many of the discovery, in fact, nearly all the pretrial matters are delegated to the magistrate judge. And the magistrate judges, by and large, have a very active case management philosophy. They believe in getting involved in the case early and often. It varies, of course, from district to district as to what the duties of the magistrate judge actually are. When you're in a state court, generally the philosophy in state courts is more reactive. The view is that discovery is conducted by the parties under the rules between themselves, and they should only be involved with the court when they have a dispute, so that the judge is in a much more reactive position than in an active case management position. Now, those are kind of the goalposts at either end of the field. There are lots of judicial philosophies in between, but a lot of this judicial philosophy is influenced by just plain on-the-ground logistics, that in state courts, you often will have a system where no one judge is assigned to the case from the time it's filed to the time it's concluded, that at each stage of the case, or perhaps every month, the judges assigned to the case changes. This is very common in our state courts to have this kind of a case management atmosphere where each time you're going to be before the judge, it could be a different judge right up until the time you're assigned a judge for trial. So it becomes very difficult under those circumstances for a judge to have an active case management philosophy, because the judge is only going to have the case for a month or perhaps a quarter, and they're going to have to pass that case on to another judge. And each time you appear, you're going to have to explain again who the parties are in the case, what their resources are, what the issues are, et cetera. So it becomes very difficult to have an active case management philosophy. Then we also just simply have vast differences in educational resources when it comes to the judges. The federal system is blessed with a federal judicial center and an administrative office for U.S. courts, which takes judicial education very seriously. And every judge, district judge or magistrate judge in the system, is provided with the time and resources for every year to be able to do judicial conferences, national workshops, and other educational forums. The states have are very uneven in the amount of funding they have, and particularly in this economic atmosphere, state budgets, state court budgets in particular, are being slashed. I mean, we have state courts that are going on to 3 and 4 day weeks. They're furloughing off employees so that judicial education tends to get short shrift. A few states have really very good educational systems for their judges. Indiana is one where there's an Indiana version of the federal judicial center that does very well. New Jersey is another state that has very good judicial education. Some states do a very good job. Others have virtually no formalized judicial education in place. And it's really up to the local bar or to national organizations to fill in the gap. Now, we know one of the lessons that we've learned, at least in the federal courts, is that the key to effective management of e-discovery is active case management. That although discovery is party controlled, having a judge involved early and often in helping the parties manage that case is the key to keeping the cost down, to moving the case along. And if you wait until you have a full-blown dispute to get the judge involved, then it's often too late, that the money's already been spent and the delays have already been generated. So that means that in many state court systems, we have a built-in disincentive for effective e-discovery management. So that's my view.
Steve and Cecil, you're both litigating these days and in these court systems. Are you seeing these types of differences between judges?
Yes. I think this is Steve. I think Ken gave a great summary. I mean, the biggest difference that I've seen is the differences between federal and state court. And I would concur. My experience is consistent with everything Ken just said. A couple other factors, at least here, the state courts that I'm familiar with, that I think make a big difference that I would add is, at least here in Indiana, most of the state courts judges don't have the support of a magistrate judge to hear discovery disputes. And so they just don't have that additional layer there of support. Nor do they generally have support of a judicial clerk to do research and to dig into a meaty discovery issue if one presents itself. And finally, you're dealing with a lot of times, particularly in a rule setting, with courts where their experience is not in the commercial cases that where we tend to see the biggest electronic discovery issues come up. But a docket dominated by, you know, criminal cases, estate matters, divorce, personal injury, those kinds of cases where e-discovery issues just are not as common as they are or virtually non-existent like the complex commercial cases.
Now, I would actually agree with all of that. The only thing that I would add is that given the fact, again, that in state court cases, e-discovery in many jurisdictions is really just starting to blossom, oftentimes courts don't necessarily understand what's at stake when they order e-discovery production or an overly broad e-discovery production. A lot of times, you know, judges will say, well, you know, this is just like, you know, any other discovery, and you have to produce it, and don't really take into consideration the respective costs or burdens given what's at stake in litigation. And I find that particularly at the state court level, as opposed to the federal court level, where we do have the federal rules in place, and again, some of the magistrates are really starting to get up to speed. It's generally at the state court level, again, without the benefit of that knowledge and understanding, where I see some rulings coming out that really do actually raise the cost of the litigation as a whole.
So Ken, this might be a softball yes or no question based on the answers before, but how important is forum to electronic discovery? Do you want to be in federal court or do you want to be in state court? That's not yes or no, but you know what I mean.
I would be hoping that you wouldn't be forum shopping based on the discovery rules, but let's make it clear there are differences between federal and state court when it comes to the rules, and those differences are reflected in judicial attitudes as well. Now, there are many states that are adopting some version of the federal rules on e-discovery. There are many states that have opted out of that, and there are a few states that are going their own way, such as California and New York in this area. But let's look at the differences, and you can take your choices from those differences. That in a federal court, you will have a mandatory early meet and confer session under Rule 26F. Most states have no such equivalent. That if the parties meet and confer before the opening of formal discovery, that would simply be a matter of local culture. A judge probably would not order it. And for the most part, the view is that you file your complaint or you file your answer, and on the same day, you file pretty much cookie-cutter discovery requests. When you get the discovery requests, you file sort of cookie-cutter responses to those discovery requests, and then you're off to the races. That would not be the way you would do things in federal court, that you would be required to meet and confer and discuss the scope of discovery, discuss issues such as preservation, the form of production, inadvertent disclosure of privileged material, before you're allowed to start formal discovery, and you would have to memorialize that discussion in a memorandum to the court itself under Rule 16, and perhaps have a Rule 16 pretrial conference very early in the discovery process. Most states don't have anything that is the equivalent of that, unless you happen to get on a complex case track, or the state is blessed with a commercial court or a business court where they have a different set of rules. So that would be the first consideration. Now, some people are very comfortable in a state court where they're not required to do that, and in fact would consider those kinds of obligations to add a layer of cost and burden. And if you're if you have just a smaller case where there's going to be virtually no document discovery to begin with anyway, which is about 60% probably of the cases filed in court have little or no document discovery, you might be more comfortable doing that and it might be cheaper for you. But if the case balloons or if there's going to be any document discovery and you have no opportunities for an early conference and the filing of a discovery plan and no opportunity for the judge to be involved, then it's kind of a big crapshoot. And you could end up in a situation where the party-controlled discovery gets out of control. So that would be, you know, that's kind of a 50,000-foot view of this, but that's my view of the difference in the jurisdictions.
Let's talk about the crapshoot situation, about some of the ways a judge can negatively or positively impact electronic discovery-heavy case. Steve, where do you see the potential for a less than informed judge to impact the case negatively?
Well, I think that Ken's described the situation pretty well. Where you have the worst situation, sort of the flip side of what Ken talked about in the federal case management process, is where you have a judge or a set of rules that give you no guidance. And that's really the worst of all possible worlds, this sort of hands-off approach that Ken described, which you can see sometimes in state court matters. Because then it just sort of becomes a free-for-all. And unless you have somebody out front of the process managing it, that's where the breakdowns tend to occur. Now, in Indiana, until recently, there were no specific rules about discovery, electronic discovery, and those rules were adopted here at effective the beginning of 2008. So that at least provided some guidance, which is kind of a starting point. But really, unfortunately, Indiana did not adopt the I don't want to make this show about Indiana, but I think it's illustrative of the things we're talking about, did not adopt the provisions in the federal rules for meet and confer and case management process And I would certainly agree wholeheartedly with Ken's comments that that's really kind of the key to successfully managing the process and avoiding a lot of the pitfalls of either costs or future disputes on discovery motions and sanctions.
Okay. Cecil, I know you have some thoughts on this as well. What are your observations?
You know, I agree with Ken and Steve, and primarily it is when a lot of these jurisdictions have put forth their e-discovery efforts, whether it be basically incorporating the federal rules wholeheartedly or cherry-picking particular rules or in some instances going their own way. It becomes difficult for agents to really get a sense of, you know, how they can best manage electronic discovery. First of all, I do agree with Ken that the very first analysis that needs to be had is whether or not electronic discovery is an issue in the case or should be brought into the case, because not all cases are electronic discovery cases, and the absolute worst thing to see is a case that is a paper case. It's a breach of contract case that involves, you know, it could be literally the quality of widgets, if you will, and there's some specific language in a contract which dictates the litigation, but now, you know, we've got parties going back and forth asking for metadata and all kinds of other things, and you're in a jurisdiction that really doesn't have a meet and confer requirement, and so all of these issues just don't even raise themselves, or they come to a head kind of in the course of discovery, which is really the last place that this should be, you know, coming up in first impression. I mean, there should be a phone call from either party very early on saying, wait a minute, you know, this isn't necessarily an e-discovery case, and if there's something specific that we need to address, we can do that, as opposed to the traditional, you know, send me any and all communications electronically with their metadata. And I'll give you another example that Steve raised. He talked about Indiana not having a meet and confer component to their rules. You know, Arizona adopted e-discovery rules last year, and as Ken can attest, there also is no meet and confer requirement in the Arizona state rules. And what compounds this and makes it a little bit more difficult is Arizona is a little bit unique because Arizona's initial disclosure statute also requires the production of the documents which you are disclosing pursuant to your initial disclosure. And so if there's no discussion with opposing counsel regarding this disclosure or this early production, if you will, of documents, you can end up in a situation where you produce documents in your initial disclosure in one format and then are getting into an issue later on in discovery about the subsequent format of documents. For instance, you print out all of your documents for the initial disclosure state and then they want them electronically later on. I mean, had you picked up the phone and called and said, hey, look, you know, can we get an agreement on the form of production, not only for the initial disclosures, but also going forward in the case and including discovery, I think, you know, you're better serving the interest of your client and also the litigation moving it forward and cooperating. But it's almost as if, since the rule doesn't require a meet and confer, there is a knee-jerk to get parties to actually pick up the phone.
Okay.
Carl, can I just add
sure.
one other thing? I think on the we're talking on the negative side. On the positive side, I think that at least in federal court, one thing that particularly would come up with a magistrate judge can do to make sure that the process is working effectively. And just because you have a meet and confer and the parties have to submit a proposed case management plan, you know, you can put form over substance, and maybe they haven't really gone to the depth that they need to discuss and look into these issues. And I think the magistrate judge can help the process, facilitate it, make sure it's meeting its function by bringing the parties into the court at the early stage and make sure they've really hashed through these issues and not just sort of, you know, cobbled together their last form and thrown it together and put it in front of the judge.
Right,
so I think that's...
We have the
Sorry.
Phenomenon of the drive-by meet and confer,
yeah.
which is always... always the bane of judges, where they ask, have you actually talked about this with the other side? This is not only in the discovery plan, but also the requirement in our federal rules and in many of the state rules as well, that if you bring a motion to compel or a motion for protective order, you're required under the rules to certify that you have actually discussed this with the opposing counsel and tried to work out a solution before you've brought it to court. And judges are often confronted with the response that, yes, I left a message on my opposing counsel's phone machine at midnight last night to discuss this, and he's never responded, so therefore I bring this motion. That the judge has to be in a position to actually ask those questions and to make sure that the parties have indeed put in the effort to try to come to some kind of cooperative solution of problems as they arise.
Now, one of the things we've been focusing on here is the differences in rules between the state and federal jurisdictions. Obviously, that impacts the judges. Ken, the interesting thing about having you on the podcast is that you're charged with educating judges in this field. First of all, tell us a little bit about how the Sedona Conference is approaching judicial education. And then secondly, where do you focus most of your energy in educating judges?
Of course, the Sedona Conference is an organization that includes not just judges, but primarily senior practitioners in the fields of antitrust, intellectual property, and complex litigation. And so over the past several years, we've had a number of educational events and conferences where we've established working groups that have developed materials that are focused on particular issues in the law, e-discovery being one of them, and under e-discovery, a number of sub-issues such as preservation, Rule 45 requests of non-parties, the issues of dealing with legacy data and not reasonably accessible data, and a number of other sub-issues under e-discovery. So what we've done is that we've had these materials are thoroughly vetted, that we make sure that all of the stakeholders in particular issues are represented in the formulation of these guidelines and principles and commentaries. That we have an advisory board also of judges, state and federal, and now state, federal, and foreign court judges as well, who review these materials to make sure that the materials are truly nonpartisan and practical and of use to judges in a variety of settings. So that, in a sense, really helps open the door to judicial education. There are a number of lobbying organizations that would like to be able to educate judges about their particular viewpoints. You have only a handful of truly nonpartisan organizations that are offering kind of high-quality education that judges can trust is not partisan and is not it doesn't represent any kind of hidden agenda. So that's our first effort, is to make sure that we're balanced and that we represent the viewpoints of all of the major stakeholders in any particular issue. The second thing is that we haven't concentrated so much on educating judges about the technical aspects of electronic discovery. There are lots of other people doing that kind of education, and that's fine, and we try to make sure that the judges know where they can get resources to be able to answer questions as they may come up. We do have, of course, the glossary and other things that help them through the thicket of the technical aspects, but we concentrate much more on educating judges about judicial management of e-discovery cases rather than have judges try to become experts in e-discovery itself, particularly experts in computer forensics or other technical aspects of e-discovery. Judges have a limited ability to decide the technical issues of all cases. They really do depend on the parties to present that. What we want to do is concentrate much more on the issues that judges have to deal with when it comes to case management and helping the parties frame a solution to the problem rather than have the judge substitute his or her own technical expertise, which is usually none in the e-discovery area, and impose solutions upon the parties. Now, in terms of the areas where we're trying, you know, we think we have the most impact, of course, we've because the federal courts have a much a better funded and better organized educational program overall, we've been able to plug into that very well with materials and with speakers at a number of events from the local level, the district court conferences and district court events, often in combination with other organizations like the Federal Bar Association, to the circuit level, circuit conferences. I'll be attending the Fifth Circuit Conference down in New Orleans later on this week, to national workshops. I just came back from the National Workshop for U.S. Magistrate Judges held in California just last week. So we're really plugged in well to the federal system. With the state courts, as I mentioned before, it's much more of a catch-as-catch-can. Each state has their own system of education and their own facilities. But there are a few national organizations that have really been on the forefront. And one in particular I'd like to mention is the American College of Business Court Judges. It's fairly new. It's only been in operation for about 3 or 4 years. But it represents the judges in state courts who are specifically assigned commercial or business litigation track cases. There are a few states that actually have formal business courts set up, like North Carolina, and Ohio just set theirs up this year. Delaware, of course, has been famous for this. These are the judges who are going to get the larger business cases, the ones who really need to know a lot about e-discovery, and we've been trying to concentrate our limited resources on educating these judges, and these judges have also been the most receptive. There may be a trickle-down effect. Hopefully we'll be able to get to the judges who are handling mainly the PI, the domestic and criminal cases in state courts, but it's going to take a while. So for now, we're concentrating on the business court judges in the state.
Let's now go into areas where there can be issues involving electronic discovery where a judge might be able to help or not. Steve, do you believe most issues are caused when one party has more electronically stored information than another party?
I think that's certainly a factor in my experience. Nothing better than, you know, during the Cold War we had that old adage about mutually assured destruction. Well, the same goes, I think, in electronic discovery in the big commercial cases where both sides have a common interest in coming up with a workable plan that makes sense with the issues before the court. That's where it's usually easiest to reach some kind of a reasonable agreement. And in the cases, on the other hand, where you have one side is not going to be affected by electronic discovery issues, does not have electronic information to produce, there you tend to see the more aggressive plays on really pushing the envelope and using electronic discovery, in my view, inappropriately as a weapon. And I do think the judges should be sensitive to that, and I think by and large that they are.
Cecil, do you think judges should be sensitive to this issue of having one party maybe with more ESI than another party, or is it just a cost of doing business for parties in litigation?
Well, no, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, obviously, I think that it starts for the big corporations, obviously, it starts with their data management and how they put their data management policies together. Obviously, less is more, but at the same time, that's no excuse for judges to just order the wholesale production of electronically stored information when there's a couple of things at play. A, the case doesn't really dictate the amounts of e-discovery that are being produced. B, the judge or the court is not willing to look at the respective burdens. You know, I think that one of the things that, particularly at the state level, is sometimes lost in the cases where one side has a lot of electronically stored information and the other side doesn't, is the concept of proportionality with respect to the responsiveness or relevant material that is going to be gained from electronically stored information. Having a party go through a mountain of electronically stored information at a very, very high cost, not only in dollars but also in staff hours to put this information together for review, and then to review it when the likelihood of getting anything responsive is A, either relatively minute, or B, simply just mirrors that which already existed in the paper realm and for which there is no real need for the electronic counterpart, you know, I really think creates a substantial burden for companies and for individuals that have a substantial amount of electronically stored information.
Steve, you've had some thoughts on this. What strategies have you found helpful when a judge hasn't imposed appropriate limits on electronic discovery, you know, the proportionality, analysis?
Well, it's an uncomfortable position to be sure, and among other reasons, because your appellate options are bad if you get a bad ruling you have a trial court judge who's unwilling to impose some limitations which you think are reasonable in the circumstances upon electronic discovery. You can run up a pretty big bill pretty fast, and so, but one strategy that I've found that works is sort of among your a number of bad options. Many times, the best choice will be simply to open the floodgates and comply with the demands. And at least I had one experience like that where we had it was pretty much anything goes from the it was a rural judge and. In a class action case, and eventually we took the approach of just producing the material. And what happened was, sort of a lesson to be learned from the class counsel, was be careful what you ask for, because they ended up getting a mountain of data that they weren't prepared to really deal with. And what the strategy did was took the sanctions sword away from them, from opposing counsel, which I think was a good part of the goal. So, you know, and I guess that illustrates, too, the resulting cost of having a judge who's not on top of these issues and not willing to dig down into them and impose some restrictions, is the costs end up being extensive for both sides. And it really, the whole process breaks down to no one's advantage as a result of all that.
Let's talk a little bit about meet and confer just briefly. Ken, I know that technically a judge isn't involved in that process, but how can a skilled judge influence a meet and confer to assist in making it successful?
Well, first, as we've already discussed, is to make sure that the meet and confer actually happens and is not just an exercise. And the best way to do that, of course, is to have a pretty clear set of expectations that the judge states at the outset of the case. That the parties will meet and confer, and they will discuss, among other things, the following issues, whatever those may be. Now, in order to do that, the judge has to have one of two things. Either is going to be thoroughly familiar with the case, which isn't going to happen, or the judge has to have a pretty good standing order or initial case management order that lays out an agenda for the meet and confer, and expects that the parties are going to produce out of that a joint memorandum that covers all of these issues and that lays out the plan for discovery. There are a couple of key things in judicial management that I think create the most effective ways to control costs and burdens in e-discovery. And first is this kind of active case management. The judge isn't making decisions for the parties, but the judge is setting a very high level of expectation that the parties are going to discuss specific issues that are potential problem areas that are recurring and from other cases. The second is that the judge has to set very firm deadlines, both in discovery and right up to the day of trial, and has to stick to them. So what the judge has to make sure that the parties are clear about is that the discovery plan that the parties propose to the judge will include a timetable, and that timetable will be, If adopted by the judge, it will be the rule of the case, that the timetable is not going to vary. So that immediately helps control the budget and helps control the mishigas that can happen if there are going to be disputes. Third, the judge has to telegraph to the parties that he or she will be readily and easily available to decide any issue that comes up or answer any questions that the party has, whether that's during the meet and confer, whether that is during a deposition, whether that is prior to either party filing a motion to compel or a motion for protective order. The judge has to say, I'm going to be available by phone, perhaps even by email. I will listen to both parties if they have a dispute or a question, and I will rule on that immediately, if not sooner. And if the judge telegraphs that attitude, miraculously, most of the disputes disappear. They never actually get to the judge. And the judge who sets those expectations early in the case is the judge who's going to end up actually doing less work on the case in the long run. Finally, the last thing that the judge must telegraph is this concept of proportionality that both Cecil and Steve have mentioned. And the judge has to make that concept of proportionality actually operative. That the judge has to say, look, when it comes to making decisions about the scope of discovery, I'm going to be asking both parties to estimate the cost of their proposed discovery or their proposed response. I'm going to be comparing that to the amount that is at stake. I'm going to be comparing that to the centrality of the issues that will be resolved by this proposed discovery to the issues in the case. I'm going to be using proportionality as the keystone here. It's not going to be the old days of the requesting party pontificating about how they have a right to everything and the responding party whining about how they can't produce anything. It's going to be based on proportionality. So at the outset of the case, the judge has to use that kind of language and to say, I'm going to be looking for numbers. I'm going to be looking for the cost of the proposed discovery or response. I'm going to be looking at the volume of documents that are being asked for or that are going to be produced. I'm going to be looking at the amount of time that it's going to take to review this stuff or get through it, and I'm going to be comparing that to the ultimate issues of the case.
We could probably take that answer and apply it to most of the rest of the questions I have here. That was a very complete answer there, Ken. But Steve, if you have sort of a take on discovery disputes, what can judges do to help out in this area, particularly the scope of review?
Well, I would concur with Ken. My experience, you know, the availability is is key. Nothing gets somebody more reasonable during a deposition. If you look them in the eye and tell them I'm going to call the magistrate's available at 2:00 to talk to us about this problem, and the problem goes away. I think the same is true in generally in discovery matters, and tends to make problems go away. But the other aspect of it is I don't think judges shouldn't hesitate to wade in and make a ruling where there is a substantial discovery dispute and rule for one side or the other without treating the situation like it's I think not so much now, but at least when I first started practicing, you'd see that. The approach was the view from the bench might be these are the kids fighting in the schoolyard and I'm going to put them both in detention. I think that kind of approach tends in the long run to produce more discovery disputes because it rewards the party who's misbehaving. But so I think you know wading in and making clear rulings and but there also has to be some care in there too because I think if sanctions and the most extreme forms of sanctions are become too available, I think that they need to be they have to be applied with some discretion because you can get in a situation where discovery takes on a life of its own. And you get more severe problems and as a result of that.
Cecil, is cost shifting an area which an unskilled judge can cause problems in? I'm thinking about my conversations with Laura Zubelik about this. She wasn't too happy about having to pay for some review of backup tapes. But go on. What's your opinion?
You know, I think cost shifting is an area where, in a lot of senses, it is an area where judges are very reluctant to go. It is very, at least in my experience, it's been very difficult to get judges to entertain the idea of cost shifting, or even to entertain the idea of requiring the production of either staggered productions to determine, you know, kind of how the cost is gonna ferret out at the end of the day, or even some type of sampling again to get a realistic sense of what it's going to cost to do that, which is either being compelled or is being requested by the opposing party. So, whether or not unskilled judges are a danger is really difficult to answer because, you know, my experience has been that, you know, cost shifting is kind of a last resort for judges. And there are some other tools that can be used before it gets to cost shifting that I'd like to see more judges get to and in fact kind of, enlist these types of tools for judges to see if we can't get them to help us resolve the dispute. I would much rather, you know, have a judge look at the proportionality of the case and say, you know what, there's just not a need for this massive production, as opposed to a judge saying, go ahead and produce all of this data, and I'm going to shift and 20% of the cost because it's generally not 100% of the cost that's being shifted. In one of the Zubelik opinions, I believe Judge Shenlin, I think, and again, I don't have the specific amount, but I think it was 20 or 30% of the cost that got shifted. It wasn't 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So I would much rather take a different tack to the extent I could and see if we couldn't put some tools in place to really educate the judge about the proportionality that needs to be taken into consideration, and specifically how much it's going to cost for us to do this, and is there a way that we can comply with this or at least take a smaller slice of that apple and determine, you know, what we're going to produce in the long haul.
Ken, do concepts like sampling and slowly letting out some of the data and trying to decide how much further you're going to go before you do cost shifting, is that the sort of thing that you're trying to educate judges on?
I think so. Of course, it depends, again, on the forum that you're in as to whether you're really going to have the latitude to do that. The concept of staged discovery, which is embodied in the federal rules in Rule 26B2B, which is the rule regarding not reasonably accessible ESI, is something that we would like to have judges think about more and more. The idea that you can have discovery of the easily accessible low-hanging fruit that is most relevant to the central issues of the case and is the cheapest and easiest to produce first. Review that, and then if we need to go any further in discovery, we can make that decision down the road. That's part of good case management. I think it's a logical thing. Judges intuitively understand that. The concept of sampling is really part of that, and that is the idea that if we're going to go into, for instance, backup tapes or some other large and not terribly accessible source of ESI, that we're first going to figure out the costs and what the potential benefits are by doing some small samples and seeing what it is there that will be found there before we order the whole-scale processing and production of this information. These things make sense to judges, but they can only be implemented where there's going to be one judge who's going to be in charge of all of the discovery from beginning to end. Mm. They can't be implemented in a system where you're going to have a different judge every 30 days. So that becomes a difficulty that we need to overcome. I should state that in terms of cost shifting is something that certainly focuses the party's attention on proportionality. If there is the possibility that the judge will order cost shifting, then there is the likelihood that the parties are going to engage in the proportionality analysis themselves before they get into some proposed discovery. And there are several states in which cost shifting is indeed part of their rules. New York is one. Texas is another. California is another. Whether the judges ignore that and operate on the assumption that the American rule applies, and that is that producing parties pay all of their own expenses in the production of documents, is a question. And in fact, in New York, you have a kind of split of authority, even though the rule itself is very clear that cost shifting to the requesting party is indeed mandatory in many cases. So the parties should be focusing on this, and the judge should be willing to telegraph that again in the initial case management order, that stage discovery and sampling will be part of that proportionality analysis that the judge wants the parties to engage in all the way along in discovery.
Okay, last question is, I can't remember if it was Cecil or Steve that talked about spoliation, but just briefly, this is something that everyone dreads, having an allegation of spoliation and a sanction. A judge can cripple a case. Is this a real threat to litigants, or are the cases with just sanctions in the field just really, truly the exception? Ken, I know you wanted to say something on this, but I'd also, Cecil or Steve, if you both have opinions, last question, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'll just make a quick observation on sanctions, and that is that although there is a lot of publicity about sanctions, the cases where the sanctions have been levied are actually fairly rare and usually egregious, although everybody's afraid of sanctions. I can speak into the federals, as to federal judges. If a federal judge is going to contemplate sanctions under Rule 37 or under their inherent powers, they're under an obligation to either hold a hearing or make findings of fact on the record. They have to draft a sanctions order. That order is most likely going to be reviewed. There is a long procedural problem with sanctions, so that in the end, most judges who are considering sanctions figure that given their caseload and everything else they have to do, the only party who's going to be sanctioned in this case is the judge. So judges are very averse to sanctions. That said, there are egregious situations, particularly in courts where the judge has seen the same problem over and over, where a judge finally sort of throws down the gauntlet and says, and this is mainly a message to the bar in general, I've had enough and I'm not going to take it anymore. But those situations are fairly rare. That said, I understand that there are a lot of people have a fear of sanctions, and there's also a lot of question about what is a sanction. You know, is a cost-shifting order a sanction, or is that a case management order? Now, that said, I'd like to hear what the practitioners feel about sanctions.
Well, no one's been sanctioned on this panel before, so.
That's correct.
We never get the bad lawyers on panels. I've always wanted to have bad lawyers on panels. It just hasn't happened. But anyway, go ahead, Cecil.
No, I was just going to say that, you know, I think Ken's absolutely right. But another thing that we're seeing just from the case law, and I think Judge Facciola mentioned it in his decision in U.S. versus O'Keefe last year, where he says, for the most part, there are just a lot of parties that are out there asking for sanctions, really not taking into effect or into account the seriousness of the allegation itself. And Judge Facciola says, you know, he quotes Shakespeare in saying, if you strike at the king, kill him, noting that, you know, you're really only going to get, I guess, one shot. But what we're seeing more often than not is that it is just kind of another tool that is brought up in every discovery dispute. You know, the party didn't comply with X, Y, or Z, we want sanctions. And the request for sanctions in discovery is not new, but now what is kind of becoming new since the rule changes, particularly in federal court, is instead of asking for discovery sanctions, everybody is gunning for a spoliation sanction. Simply because the stakes are a lot higher with the spoliation sanctions. So, you know, these motions are almost automatically coming out with allegations of failures to preserve evidence, and that evidence was always critical or crucial to the smoking gun to the case. So that's kind of what, you know, what I'm seeing looking at some of the case law that's out there.
And I agree. I think it's the spoliation charge and the request for sanctions is one that you see too common. I think in some circles it's almost becomes like a strategy, you know, a common strategy in these cases, if nothing else, to try to get some leverage and towards settlement or for some other purpose. And I think that really that those remedies ought to be limited to the most egregious sorts of situations. I think that's not only appropriate, I think that is appropriate, but also I think that serves the deterrent effect that Ken made reference to. I mean, we all know about the Qualcomm case and some of the things that have happened there, and those cases, Zublocki, I mean, those cases become infamous, and they do take on a lot of create a lot of fear amongst the bar, which is what I think produces the kind of thing that Cecil was talking about, where you see that those kinds of allegations are thrown around because they do have a big impact.
Well, I've enjoyed moderating this topic. I think it's an interesting look at the different systems and what can happen with judges of different backgrounds and different rules. So I appreciate you guys hanging around and talking about this with us here. And I'd like to let all the listeners know, for a comprehensive list of podcasts, you can go visit www.esibytes.com with a Y, BYTES.com. And also remember that our goal at ESI Bytes is to help you learn bits or bytes of ESI information before electronically stored information bites you back when you're unprepared. So thanks again, everyone. And if the speakers want to hang on for a second, we can chat about the show. All right. Take care.